Good evening. Just had a nice cup of tea. And I'm ready for a story. Or an anecdote. We're at page, 28. Letter C. A printer by training can't, was playing around at amateur dramatics when he was offered a professional acting job and quit work the next day. After some time as a jobbing actor, he auditioned for a new BBC children's show called Play School, and then began his stint in living rooms across the land. Following an early period of heavily scripted shows, Kant got more involved in the production of Play School and ended up writing whole weeks of episodes. These were never live, so many people assume, but recorded a week ahead. His appearance on Play School landed him some voiceover work for Gordon Murray and Freddie Phillips, who were putting together an animated series for the BBC called Camberwick Green. This was such a success that he was asked back to do the same for Trumpton and Chigley, recording his material to a converted broom in a converted broom cupboard. Kant didn't get to see the animations at the time, and to this day has not seen every episode from the series. Play Away evolved from Play School and was aimed at older children and recorded in front of a live studio audience. During his time on that show, he worked alongside actors such as Jeremy Irons and Tony Robinson, both of whom went on to enjoy success with adult audience. But Kant will always be remembered for his work in children's television. The book says still acting today, but actually, poor old Brian passed away last year. He appears regularly on stages. Personally, I think it's about time that his significant achievements and his place in the memories of millions was recognised with an honour. Perhaps a knighthood is out of his reach, but an OBE or something like that? Would that be too much to ask?
Is a box, a musical box, wound up and ready to play. But this box can hide a secret inside. Can you guess what is in it today? the salesman. Hello, Mr. Dagenham.
I'm just having a nostalgicasm. The things that remind me of my home when I grew up. Now the next one, Frank Capra movies. Oh, the word Capra-esque is often used to describe a movie or anything really which is heartwarming, life-affirming, and slightly magical in quality. It came about because of the director Frank Capra's tendency to produce films that tickled all those bones. And many of his productions considered all-time classics. His films include Mr. Deeds Goes to Town or It Happened One Night, which starred Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. Oh, shoot, that was a good film. And because the first film in history to win an Oscar for every major category. Coming from a working class background, Frank Capra was drawn to stories about the little man fighting against the odds. Something epitomised by James Stewart's performance in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington and It's a Wonderful Life. Capra himself was by many accounts not a particular nice chap, but he was an excellent film director. He also knew how to pair up with talented people. Many of his more successful films were penned by screenwriter Robert Riskin, a man whose vision is probably more aligned to the true meaning of Capra-esque. Three Frank Capra movies appear in the American Film Institute's list of the 100 greatest American movies of all time. These are It's a Wonderful Life at number 11, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington at number 29, and It Happened One Night at number 35.
Excuse me, lady, but that upon which you sit is mine.
I beg your pardon.
Now listen, I put up a stiff fight for that seat, so if it's just the same to you, scram.
Driver, are these seats reserved?
Nah, first come, first served.
Thank you.
Hey, driver, these seats accommodate two people, don't they?
Well, maybe they do and maybe they don't.
Thank you.
Points if you know which film that one's from. Naughty of me to have it just that excerpt, but there you go. Now, oh, cartoons. Oh, yes. An artist draws an image on a sheet of paper. He then draws a slightly different image on another sheet. By quickly flicking between the two, he creates the illusion of movement. And he has made a cartoon. Take thousands of artists drawing, well, millions of images over the past 100 years or so, and you have a universe of animation that has brought joy, awe, wonder, and amazement to everyone who has had the pleasure to witness them. Pardon me. Cartoons unite us. They make us all smile. They are an experience we share with everyone else who has ever watched one. When my sons laugh at Bugs and Daffy arguing over wabbit season, duck season, he is reliving the laughter I expressed when I was his age watching that very scene, which is precisely the same as my father before me. Every now and then, some morally outraged individual will complain about all the violence in animated cartoons, and they will point to Jerry smashing Tom's face in with an iron or Wile E. Coyote getting crushed by an anvil and suggest that it is corrupting the minds of minors. I say, as the book says, that they clearly didn't watch enough cartoons as a kid. If they did, they'd have a bloody good sense of humour. What's your favourite cartoon? Children's paintings. On one hand, the critical and artistic one. Children's paintings are basically crap. Of course they are. They are created by people with no artistic talent and with the most basic of materials. They tend to look nothing like their intended subject. On the other hand, the emotional and the creative one, they are little rectangles of pure imagination. A blue strip of sky clings desperately to the top of the page. A monster with 13 legs and eyes hovering somewhere above its head explodes in a riot of colour. An incomprehensible mass of points and swirls together into impossible shapes. Go and see an infant school art display sometime, and they will be the greatest pictures you will ever see. If you still aren't convinced that children's paintings aren't the most rewarding form of art we have, then ask yourself this. Why is it that all the great modern artists spend their adult lives trying to see the world as children again? If you want to paint as well as Picasso, you either have to be a genius or 5 years old. Chinese chips. Obviously, it is a bit silly to order chips from a Chinese takeaway. But if you have ever done so, you will know that the Chinese have a secret magic recipe. Somehow, their chips taste nicer than any others. I have no idea how they prepare them. I have never thought to ask. Perhaps they cook them in a wok. Whatever it is they do, it elevates the chipped potato to a whole new level. Church bells. I don't care what religion you are, the ringing of church bells on a sunny spring morning is a joy to the ear. Close encounters with wildlife. Oh, not that wild. Remember, this is safe for work. Most wild animals steer well clear of us human beings. Humans. A very wise move too. We have a tendency to kill them for food, for sport, or out of sheer boredom. So when an otherwise shy creature happens across your path and doesn't instantly flee, it is a rare privilege. Those brief seconds, silent and still, can seem timeless. As you make eye contact and, for a moment, you acknowledge each other's presence, it is as if you are communing with nature an almost spiritual level, it is enough to humble even the most cynical of humans. Clouds. Floating above our heads every day are the stuff of dreams and poetry. The most amazing sight in nature are just an upwards glance away. Don't just take my word for it. Here's someone who knows far more about it than me. An interview with Gavin Pretor-Pinney, founder of the Cloud Appreciation Society. What inspired you to start the Cloud Appreciation Society? A few years back, a friend asked me to give a talk about clouds for her literary festival. She knew how enthusiastic I was about them, and, of course, I said yes. But in the weeks before the event, I worried that no one would come along, since most people complain about clouds. It occurred to me that they might be more likely to come if I gave the talk an interesting name. So I called it the Inaugural Lecture of the Cloud Appreciation Society, even though no such society existed. And when the talk was packed out and everyone came up, When the talk was packed out and everyone came up afterwards to ask how they could join, I figured that it was about time I started a society for real. How many members do you have? There are currently 7,700 members in 42 different countries, with more joining every day. What are the benefits of membership as opposed to, I don't know, just looking up at the sky? Sorry, I like these questions. There are no particular benefits. This just tickles me. We have yet to negotiate with airlines for members to have priority booking and window seats. But when you spend £3 to become a member, you get a badge and a certificate with your name and membership on it. This states that you will pledge to persuade all who listen to the wonder and the beauty of clouds. Of course, you don't need to be a member to look up and enjoy clouds. They are there for anyone to enjoy. They belong to everyone and to no one. It's about time someone stood up for clouds. It's just about that, really. Any famous cloud spotters among your number? Or is that a secret? I have the utmost respect for the privacy of our members. Still, I can divulge that memberships include a celebrity chef, a musician or conceptual artist who had a number one hit single, and a husband and wife TV presenter duo. What is it about clouds that you like so much? I like the way they bring variety and drama to the skies. Life would be dull if we had to look up at monotonous blue skies day after day. Clouds are precious precisely because they are so transient. Every cloudscape is unique, and clouds generally are useful metaphors for life down on Earth. Just one of the reasons for their great credentials as subjects of poetry and art. Put simply, clouds are for dreamers and their contemplation. It benefits the soul. A few minutes looking up each day to let your mind float along with the clouds is the best form of meditation I know. It helps alleviate you above earthly concerns and saves on psychoanalysis bills. What is your all-time favourite cloud? This should be good. It is either the Pileus cloud or the lenticular cloud. A Pileus cloud is like a cloud haircut. It looks like a blow-dried bouffant and sometimes forms on top of the puffy cauliflower-like summit of a large cumulus cloud. It only lasts a few minutes before the cumulus grows up through it. It therefore embodies the transitory, ephemeral nature of clouds. A lenticular cloud tends to form in hilly or mountainous regions. It looks like a flying saucer. Unlike most clouds that blow along in the wind, the lenticular formation hovers, more or less stationary in a brisk breeze. One of the joys of cloud spotting is finding shapes, so this UFO-shaped cloud is a winner. Cloud spotters, are they anoraks or poets? Both. And that's the beauty of it. That's such a British thing to say. Do you think people who appreciate clouds have a more optimistic outlook on life? That's a leading question, wasn't it? Anyway, yes. What could be more optimistic than finding profound beauty in the everyday? Let others find clouds mundane. Let them spend 50 weeks of the year wishing they were on holiday somewhere else where the sky is always blue. If a dramatic display of altocumulonimbus cast in the warm light of the setting sun appear only once in a generation, it would become a legend. I don't think the fact that it happens on a weekly basis makes it any less remarkable. The Cloud Appreciation Society can be found online at www.cloudappreciationsociety.org. Gavin Pretor-Pinney is the author of The Cloud Spotter's Guide, published by SEPTA. Next category. Columbo. Peter Falk's portrayal of the seemingly hapless LAPD homicide detective, Lieutenant Columbo, has become one of the most popular character performances in television history. With its genre-breaking format, the audience knew the identity of the killer from the start, from the outset. The show became hugely popular during the 1970s, although the pilot episode was shot as far back as 1968. In fact, the character of Columbo dates from much earlier, having appeared in a one-off TV drama in 1960, written by creators Richard Levinson and William Link. In that live broadcast, Columbo was played by Bert Fried. I never knew that. Although it had a unique approach to the cop show format, the makers of Columbo were not averse to the world of cliché, and the programme built up its own repertoire over the years, much to the delight of fans and aficionados. Enthusiasts revel in hearing Lieutenant Columbo under utter his catchphrase, "Just one more thing," or "About that alibi of yours." I'm not going to try and do the accent. Watching him try to find somewhere to stub out his cigarette or parking his battered old Peugeot really badly. The original 1970s show featured a cornucopia of special guests starring The original 1970s series featured a cornucopia of special guests of special guest stars, including William Shatner, Robert Culp, oh, he played a baddie, yes, remember that, Johnny Cash, oh yeah, and Leonard Nimoy. But it was a breeding ground for a significant talent behind the scenes as well. John Cassavetes, Jonathan Demme, and Steven Spielberg all directed episodes. I never knew that. Sorry. Now, a staple of weekday afternoon television, Columbo continues to find new audiences every year, and its appeal looks likely to go on for many more years to come. Fascinating fact. Despite the protests of Columbo's star and creators, NBC produced a show called Mrs. Columbo in 1979. It featured the crime-stopping adventures of the lieutenant's supposed wife and starred Kate Mulgrew, who later went on to captain the USS Enterprise in Star Trek Voyager. Unsurprisingly, it was cancelled after one season. I never knew that either. Constellations. If clouds are the poetry, then constellations are definitely the stories of the sky. They are thought to have been created by farmers in ancient times in order to more or less easily determine the seasons. They imagined shapes and characters with the stars and their formations, and some historians believe that these were the genesis of many of the ancient myths. By telling stories around these characters, they were better able to remember them and to pass them down to the next generation. Modern astronomy has changed the original formation somewhat, so that now every star in the sky is in exactly one constellation. There are 88 official constellations in the night sky. It's a nice thought, isn't it? Children being taught by adults at bedtime what all those stars were, what they meant, what they looked like, as they get more and more tired before bed, before sleep.